Hi, everybody. Thank you for that warm welcome, and thank you all for being here still. I know that we're a mere 10 minutes after 4:20 and only 30 minutes till the Oregon Ducks game, so those of you who held out, I much appreciate you being here. And I'm going to make a disclaimer just at the start. I got in rather late last night from my honeymoon for a week in the San Juan Islands, and so thank you. So if at any point in time I sort of stare off in the distance and look wistful, I'm still in some hot tub on Orcas Island. So I'll do my best to focus. You do your best to focus, because I do think these are really important topics, and I'm really excited to be here and be able to share with you all. I am an attorney at Fisher & Phillips. Fisher & Phillips is a nationwide law firm with offices in 31 different cities, and we're a boutique employment law firm. So all we do is represent employers on employment law topics. That specialization, of course, allows us to specialize and be efficient and be experts in that field. So our goal is to advise employers regarding the laws and what you can and can't do. We want all of our clients to comply with the law, be good employers, treat their employers as well as possible. If and when that preventative compliance work doesn't work, and somebody does end up bringing a lawsuit, or a state or federal agency brings an administrative claim, we of course represent employers at that point as well. So just to move on, my goal here today is to impress upon you how important it is to comply with these laws. And I know that you've heard from a number of people today, and you will hear from more tomorrow, regarding sort of how special you are in the marijuana industry and how certain laws apply to you differently, for better or worse if you're talking tax laws. So how you're somehow special or different. By and large, this isn't that talk. You will, as you just heard, you will be treated just like every other employer, just like the mom and pop down the street, just like Starbucks, just like everyone else. And so the suite of employment laws, somewhat depending on the size of your company, but the suite of employment laws are going to apply to you. And so it's important that you're cognizant of what's out there, you know the potential problems with not complying, and you do what you can to minimize your exposure to liability. So if you employ people, and let's just do that, just so I know who I'm working with. How many people have at least one employee? Okay, good. This is relevant to all of you. And how many people are thinking about getting into the business right now and think they might get an employee? So this is relevant to you. So hopefully that covers most of the stretch. Even if you just work for a business as an employee, if you get to a management sort of level, this is what you'll be thinking about as a manager. So we'll start. I haven't used this yet, so please forgive me. Okay, so overview. As I said, you know, there's a number of ways in which cannabis businesses are subject to different laws than other businesses. Employment's not one of them. You're going to be subject to literally hundreds of state and federal employment laws and regulations. It's just a fact of nature that in the past, particularly pre-even medical marijuana, but even pre-recreational, a lot of cannabis businesses, you know, however you want to classify that term, had very informal relationships with their employees, maybe not even thinking of them as employees, but your trimmers, your distributors, whatever they may have been in the past and whatever they will be in the future, all of these were employees under the definition of employee, which means somebody that you either suffer or permit to work, right? So that means you either actually hire them and tell them what to do, or just allow them to work. If you go and go to a Walmart and just start volunteering, they'll make you leave, because you're an employee as soon as you start volunteering for them. Payment's not the definition of employee, right? It's if you do work. So all these people in the past were employees of cannabis businesses, but as we all know, there were certain traditional ways of doing things. And as the cannabis business comes more and more into the light of day, as it were, as it becomes more and more legitimate, you can expect more and more scrutiny. You can expect more scrutiny from the federal and state employment agencies, like the Bureau of Labor and Industries here in Oregon, or the Department of Labor. And you can expect more scrutiny from plaintiff's attorneys who are looking for clients. And so this is going to be on their radar as they think there's more and more there, as it were. So the most important points from this talk, if you get nothing else, and I understand it's late again, so just take this part down. Most important points today, you need to have clear written policies that set out the baseline rule book for your company, more or less. And you got to enforce those evenly. The second most important thing is when you start to get into a hairy situation where an employee starts to make certain complaints, you know you have to fire an employee or otherwise deal with an employee, you need to call an expert beforehand. Certain things can be handled by sort of HR professionals. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but there are third parties that can supply those services. More complicated things are when you're first trying to set up a handbook or a payment compensation scheme, better to talk to an attorney. Doesn't have to be us, but talk to someone, because we're going to go through, there's a list of preventable things that you can prevent and can cost you a lot of money if you don't. So why does this matter to you? This is a list right here of every federal lawsuit filed in the United States federal courts, district courts, in a single day. This list does not include administrative claims filed with state administrative agencies, administrative claims filed with federal administrative agencies, state lawsuits, arbitration actions. Doesn't include any of those things, all of which are filed, most of which in greater numbers than these federal lawsuits. In fact, in 2013, 6.5% of all civil lawsuits filed in federal courts, still talking about federal courts alone here, involved employment issues. And every year, the legislature, both Congress, but even more so the Oregon State Legislature, enacts new laws pertaining to employment, providing new causes of actions for employment or employees if the employer either, you know, intentionally ignores the law or just missteps. So the litigation is high. Litigation as well in the administrative realm. So EEOC's, the Equal Opportunity Commission, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, excuse me, and BOLI is the Bureau of Labor and Industries. EEOC's the federal and BOLI's the state agency. And their claims are going up as well. So those administrative claims are also increasing. So there is liability out there. There is exposure. There's a lot of laws, a lot of technicalities you can get tripped up on. And if you get tripped up or miss that, the feds, the state, or the plaintiffs will come for you. So we're here today to learn how to avoid becoming one of those statistics. You know, you don't want to see your business's name on the second half of the V in one of those lawsuits, right? So-and-so V your business never looks very good. So let's try to avoid those, and we'll talk more about this as we move forward. But these are kind of baseline things that every employer should do immediately when they employ one person, really. You need to have a handbook setting out your specific policies. I talked about that written policies part. There's a little more in depth. So you need to have that handbook that sets out the policies and lets you know, lets all the employees know exactly what is required of them, what the punishments may be if they don't comply. You know, you don't want to have one of your employees like Tom Brady who says, well, I didn't know I could get suspended for it, so therefore, and the judge agreed with him, so I'm not debating that necessarily. However, the Patriot fandom splits in this room. But that's sort of the issue, right? You don't want to have, try to enforce a punishment after the fact when you don't have a clear policy set up. So you need to have a handbook that sets out your policies. You need to get that handbook signed or an acknowledgement page signed for the employee so they can't later say, well, okay, you might have had that written up, but it was stuck in an office drawer, I never saw it, right? And from the handbook flows a lot of things. We'll talk about harassment reporting shortly. The handbook's what sets out, you know, who you report that to as an employee. And that's really important. It gives you certain defenses we'll talk a little bit more about. Document everything. You're required by law to document the wages and the hours worked for all your employees. It's going to become even more important starting January the 1st of this year when the Oregon sick leave law takes effect statewide. Some of you have already probably dealt with it in Eugene and Portland, but it'll be statewide starting January the 1st. And so you're going to have to keep up with those hours just to know whether or not you're complying with that law. The really important thing to avoid sort of lawsuits, not wage lawsuits, but discrimination type lawsuits, is that you gotta document the discipline. You know, you can really have, you know, think of the worst employee you can possibly think of. You've put up with it for 6 months or so. It's finally time to let this person go. But the day before you want to do that, they report something, right? I'm injured, I'm pregnant, I'm whatever. Now you're in a really tough spot. You are gonna fire them the next day. But if you do that, it's so close in time to their telling you they're pregnant that you've got a lawsuit. The way you protect yourself is if you have 6 months worth of documentation of the bad behavior, you know, violations of laws or performance issues. So documentation, you're gonna hear me say documentation too many times today. It's really important. And clearly designate your HR manager. Have somebody, if it's an outside third party, that's fine. But you also need to have at least one managerial level employee who's designated to be that HR contact. The HR person deals with medical information, you know, sick leave policies and that sort of stuff, and that can be protected by HIPAA, the portability healthcare privacy law. And it just needs to be with a single need-to-know person. You don't want everybody in your company knowing everybody else's medical history. Well, you can't have that. So make sure you designate one HR manager. And then the final way to avoid becoming a statistic and what we'll spend the rest of our time on here is know the most common issues and traps. We're going to go through a couple of the things that we see most often in my practice where employers get tripped up. You know, usually it's not... It's very seldom that we get the case where it's truly, man, that's a bad employer. You know, they were really sexually harassing everybody in the office and it was horrible, right? That's not normally the case. Usually it's people who just get tripped up on small things or fail to think things through before they act. And that's where a little advice can come in handy. So without further ado, somehow I lost my, there, okay. So the first trap is not using a written application form. Don't just hire the first person who responds to your Craigslist ad with an email. It's just not the best way to do it. The application can give you a number of things. One, it's a valuable tool for pre-screening people in a controlled setting. In the interview, somebody from your company has to ask questions, and that can lead to some problems, which we'll talk about next. But talk about later on down here. But the application itself is a controlled, it's been vetted, it's been read over, there's nothing bad in it. And then you can take that application and you can use it to screen out bad versus good applicants. It also allows you to include arbitration clauses if you decide to do that. You saw that litigation arbitration can be a good way to avoid some of that litigation. So you can include an arbitration clause. We actually do a separate arbitration agreement from the application itself, but it's all part of the same thing. And I caution you against using sort of an online hatched application. It needs to be specific to Oregon if you're in Oregon, specific to Washington if you're in Washington, so on and so forth, because they have special rules. You may have heard Oregon banned the box this last legislative session. So yay, yes, exactly. It's a fantastic rule. It will help certain employees at least get past that initial point and get a FaceTime before they're just excluded, which is a positive thing. So the ban the box pretty much says you can't ask about prior criminal background history in the application. You can't ask about it prior to the interview. So if you go into one of the online folks and you just print out some application, it's likely to have a check this box if you've been convicted of a felony. If you use that after January, you're in violation of the law. So just make sure you're specific that way. Ask for references. It's important, both personal and professional. It's hard to get anything of value from professional references these days. People just say the dates you worked and the like, but personal references can be useful that way. And then when it comes to the interview itself after the application, don't make any promises about tenure. Oregon's still at will, we'll talk a little bit more about that, which means you can fire somebody for no reason at all, theoretically. unless you've made a contract. Do a great job and you'll never get fired here. You know, if you work here hard, you've got a long career ahead of you. Just stay away from these things. You're given the impression that they have some sort of contract of employment. And then in the actual interview, you want to avoid certain questions, and we can go into more depth. If you ever have any questions about that, just let me know. You need to just have a list of sort of the things to stay away from in the interview. The things that trip people up, so, you know, in the course of the conversation, it turns out that somebody has a child. You know, do you have babysitting lined up? How are you going to be here for work? You're a single, you know, they told you they're a single parent. You didn't ask the question. You're in trouble. You want to stay away from anything family and health related and talk about work, past and future work. So, so you've got your application. It doesn't do any good if you don't follow through on it. So you want to screen. You want to make sure that you do contact the references and make sure that those references pan out, or at least are neutral, at the very least. You don't want to get bad references. Look for any of the warning signs on the application itself. If somebody turns in a crinkled up, coffee-stained application with scratch marks and doodles all over it, you know, you can decide what kind of employee you want to employ, but generally, that's a sign that you can take into consideration. You know, do you want their work product to be of a similar caliber? So those are the little things you can look at. Gaps in employment history, you know, some are explicable. It's just things to look into further. Victim-like responses, you know, my last employer and I didn't see eye to eye. You know, okay. You might want to know more about that one, right? But then once you get there, interview aggressively. Ask them about their employment background. Ask them why they left their previous jobs. Okay, number three. I'm going to pick up the pace here because we're getting close. So failing to recognize leave or accommodation requests. The number one point I'm going to try and impress upon you here is that it's the employer's obligation to identify whether or not an employee is entitled to medical leave or to disability accommodations. The employee doesn't have to use any fancy language. They don't have to say, I want federally protected medical leave. No, they just have to say, I'm sick or my kid's sick. I need time off. And then you need to go through the analysis of which laws apply to you based on the size of your business. You know, and Oregon's paid sick leave is going to apply to all employers, no matter the size. But you need to recognize that if some employee starts talking to you about medical or physical limitations or problems and is asking for anything, I want to use dictation software, I want a treadmill desk, I want whatever, that triggers that you're in the world of protected medical things and you need to investigate more. I can't go into all this. I mean, this is a 4-hour seminar by itself. But what I want you to do is be able to issue spot. I have an employee who's come up to me and talk to me about medical issues. I now need to call my HR person. I now need to call my attorney. The most common liability is actually retaliation. It's not failing to give the leave, it's retaliating. They get fired within 6 months after taking the leave and they think it's because they took the leave. You don't think it's because they took the leave, you think it's because of performance. But that's what goes on, and so always be cognizant of those contemporaneity issues too. If something follows close in time, if an adverse employment action follows close in time to something protected, you're in higher exposure land. Also, under the Americans with Disabilities Act in particular, there's a part called the interactive process. And this is a standalone requirement. So the ADA requires that employers not discriminate against people with disabilities. And that includes a requirement that you accommodate any disability as long as you can do so without an undue hardship to let them do the essential functions of their job. This is another reason why you need to have policies, right? You need to have a job description that describes those essential functions so that later on down the line you can rely on that and say they couldn't perform the essential functions. You know, it says right here they have to be able to lift 75 pounds because that's how much the fertilizer bags weigh or whatever the case may be, right? So have those requirements written down so you can rely on them later. Point being, standalone requirement, if somebody comes up to you and says, I need a treadmill desk, or I need indefinite leave to deal with my depression, you may say, that's ridiculous, that's an undue burden. You're probably right. But if you just jump to that without talking to the employee and you just let them go, even if you were gonna be right, you're now liable for failing to engage in that interactive process. So you need to document that. You need to talk with the employee, figure out what their limitations are, and try to come up with ways that they can perform those essential functions despite their physical limitations. Documentation, again, is the number one thing there. Failing to pay the minimum wage or overtime. Federal and state law require that you pay all employees, unless specifically exempt under those statutes, minimum wage at the specific rate, and overtime at 1.5 times their regular rate. Regular rate usually means what you pay them per hour. And it can get complicated in certain situations, and depending on your business, there might be some things called like fluctuating work week or the like that can help you save some money there. The one area that's maybe specific to cannabis, and I might get to this in another slide, and I apologize, is that there may be a federal wage and hour exemption, the agricultural exemption, that could allow you to pay trimmers piece rate without having to pay overtime. So if you're dealing with trimmers, give me a call. We can talk about that a little bit more. You can just pay them their flat piece rate and not have to pay them overtime. If you don't qualify for that exemption, piece rate workers have to be paid overtime. And it's a complicated math formula. You figure out how much they made, divide by the hours they worked, and get their regular rate, blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't matter if they work on salary. We'll just go to the next slide because it gets there. So these are misconceptions, right? Misclassifying employees is a huge, huge hot button issue right now. Just because you call somebody a salaried employee, I'll pay you $50,000 a year, that does not mean they're exempt from overtime. In fact, as of next year, it means they're not exempt from overtime because the Obama administration just raised the lowest threshold salary to $50,400 per year. And if you're under that, they're not exempt automatically. If you're above that, they're exempt as long as they meet a few additional requirements, okay? So just because they're salaried doesn't mean you don't pay overtime. That's a common thing. Oh, he's on salary, I don't pay him overtime. Doesn't work that way. And eventually they go back to 3 years worth of overtime pay that you haven't paid them, and it's a lot of money. Independent contractors, huge hot button issue. Yoga instructors, strippers at strip clubs, you know, you name it, they've been treated as independent contractors, and almost every single time the courts or the agencies have looked at it, they're not independent contractors. Strippers aren't independent contractors, you know. They work at the same place every night, and they get paid by the club. So that's where we're coming to the yoga folks the same way. Now, there will be some I met at least one consultant here. He actually works for a lot of different people, has his own business. He's an independent contractor. But the Department of Labor recently came out with a memo that the headline stated, almost all workers are employees, not independent contractors. They've made it their banner issue for the last 3 years, and they're going after folks. So if you think somebody's an independent contractor, check with somebody before you pay them that way. There's also, so a lot of people are working on branding right now. You might have outside salespersons or retail commission folks. There are specific requirements that apply there. It's gonna be really specific to your business. So if you do have outside salespersons branding for you or otherwise, check into those specific issues. Number 7, we're gonna go faster. Failure to pay the final paycheck on time. This one hits everybody. Nobody gets this right, at least initially, until you've gotten sued or a letter from an attorney at least once. Oregon's really particular about this, okay? So you need to just have a list by your side, and anytime an employee is leaving employment, look at your list and see when you have to pay them. So this is their final paycheck. It has to include everything that they're owed at the end of employment. And this is a freebie point at the bottom there. Never deduct anything from your employees' paychecks other than federally and state required withholdings like Social Security and federal taxes. If the employee owes you, you know, $200 for product or hats and t-shirts or whatever, you get that from them some way other than deducting their paychecks. You're not allowed to do that. The mere fact that the employee owes you money doesn't mean you get to take it out of their paycheck, okay? You have to tell them to pay you, and if they don't pay you, eventually you have to sue them just like anybody else would. That's your only avenue. You can't deduct from their paychecks. So this is really quick because I don't remember it, and I do this every day. So have a list. If you're firing the individual or they're quitting by mutual agreement, you have to have it on their final paycheck before the end of the first business day after that termination. You fire somebody on Wednesday, you have to pay them by the end of the day on Thursday. All right? That can be difficult if you have a paycheck company. Might take a little pre-thinking. I want to fire this person on Wednesday, but I can't get a check by Thursday, so I'm now going to fire this person on Monday because I can have a check by Tuesday. Okay? If the employee quits with less than 48 hours notice, you have to give it within five, it's actually business days of the next payday, and if it falls on a Saturday, you go over to the next one. We'll talk about that if you have questions. And if they give at least 48 hours notice, you got to have it the day that they quit. Huge penalties if you don't do this. And this also applies to just failure to pay overtime or minimum wage during their employment as well. Oregon has a statute, and it's Oregon's penalty wage statute, that pretty much says in a nutshell that if you fail to pay on that schedule that I just showed you, the employee can recover wages at his or her regular rate, so say they're a $15 an hour employee, for 8 hours a day for up to 30 days. I can get cut off earlier if you pay them like 3 days after it was due, right? They only get 3 days of full wages. Where it really hits you is you didn't pay overtime, right, all throughout their employment. Now they're bringing this for the full 30 days because you still didn't know until their attorney wrote you a letter. And so you can end up with this situation where you failed to pay a $15 an hour employee, like say a dollar of overtime wages. That is rare, but you know, it can be a very small sum. That $15 employee may end up being owed $3,600 in penalty wages because you made this small mistake. And then if you don't correct it, they'll sue, and if they sue and they win, they recover their attorney's fees. If they sue and they lose, you don't recover your attorney's fees from them and you still pay your defense attorney. It's a no-win. That's why the compliance side of this is so important. That's why getting it right is so important. Failure to recognize harassment issues. Oregon has 32 different protected classifications. Every single person in this room fits into multiple of those classifications. Oftentimes, when employees get let go, terminated from their employment, they're upset about it. They don't think it's their fault, and so they attribute it to something else. Sometimes they'll attribute that to a protected classification, and that's where you get a discrimination lawsuit. They were treated differently based on anything, right? And the 32, it's the common ones like you think of the sex, color, race, ethnicity, national origin, and so on and so forth. But it gets pretty esoteric. You know, if you discriminate against a guy with a degree in theology, you can be in trouble. So big point, your handbook should have clear in it how a complaint of harassment or discrimination gets reported to your designated HR person. That gives you a defense, so make sure they know how to report anything that they think's a problem. Then investigate that, deal with it, get involved early. Final slide.
Okay.
Very final slide. Failing to document. You got a document. It is at will, which means you can fire for no reason, but juries don't buy that, right? If you don't have a reason, juries aren't going to buy it. Have it documented. Have a good, articulable reason why you let this person go, whether it's your finances or their performance, and have the documents to be able to back up that decision so when you have to explain it to a jury, you're able to do so. And knowing that I have no time for questions, stop by my booth if you have any questions. I'm right outside here. We still got a few of the punching pins, and we have a sign-up sheet if anybody wants to sign up.